Chapter 14. The hum of the water going quiet and the hiss of the door rouses John from a drifting sort of half-daze, and he rolls over, looks up as Jaster emerges from the fresher, running a towel over his hair. Water clings to him in droplets and streams, lingers in the curve of muscle and drips down the planes of his body, and for just a moment, John can't breathe for the beauty of him. Jaster doesn't notice. He's cold, searching for his thickest pair of pants, and John can see the shiver that traces down his spine, the way he curls the towel around his shoulders as soon as his hair is dry. Concerned, John sits up, watching him carefully as he pulls on his pants, and then says, "Sonic's might have been warmer." Jaster's smile is rueful as he turns. "They may have, yes, one more oversight, it seems," he agrees, and drops his towel on the trunk at the foot of the bed as he passes. John pulls the blankets back for him, and he slides under quickly, pulling them back up over his shoulders. There's a faint pause, but after a moment, he sighs in something that sounds like relief and closes his eyes. A little amused, John sinks down with him, evening out the blankets. There's a careful space between them, one that he didn't create, so he lets it stand, settling against the pillow and closing his eyes again. The weight of exhaustion seems a softer thing now, with Jaster safe and close enough that John can hear his heartbeat, and even if the urge to touch lingers, John lets it be. He doesn't need to, not when Jaster so clearly wants to maintain at least a little space. Jaster asked him to stay, so he will. Whether that means touch or not, it doesn't matter. "Tired?" Jaster asks, low, and John doesn't open his eyes, just makes a rough sound of agreement in his throat. "I healed what Montross did," he says, pressing a hand over his stomach. It is healed, he knows that much. Just sore still. He likely will be for a while. Dark Woman's techniques lean more towards function than comfort, particularly when John uses them. He was always a poor student. "I thought you said it would be a strain," Jaster says with concern, and cold fingers brush across John's arm, curl around his bicep. Before John can answer, though, a shiver rocks Jaster, a deep-seated tremor that practically rattles his teeth in his head, and Jaster huffs, sinking back down with a grimace. "Criff, if I'm sick for the wedding," he says, half-muffled by the blanket, "Miles will hang me from the tallest cliff he can find and marry you in my place." John tries his best to hide his amusement, but a trace of worry rises as well. He catches Jaster's hand as it withdraws, tightening his grip on Jaster's fingers, and says quietly, "I can help." Jaster pauses, dark eyes interested despite the next shiver that shakes him. "Healing?" he asks. "Or a Jedi trick?" John doesn't roll his eyes. "Quite." "Yes," he says, "an ancient Jedi trick passed down between masters. Roll onto your side." Jaster does as he's told, shifting over, and raises a brow at John expectantly. "Well?" John keeps hold of his hand, sliding down a little further. Then, careful, he rolls over and slides back, settling into the curve of Jaster's body. He pulls Jaster's arms around him, pressing into him, and tries not to wince at the deep chill of Jaster's skin. For a long second, Jaster is completely frozen, like he can't even move. Then, with a ragged sound of relief, he wraps John up in his arms, curls around him tightly until practically every inch of their skin is pressed together, and makes a low, grateful sound against John's neck. "Nine hells," he breathes, grip almost bruising, and John pulls the covers tighter around them, reaches up, and covers Jaster's freezing hands with his own. I believe I've well and truly learned my lesson this time. John hides his smile against the pillow. I'm sure Arla will be glad to hear that. No more camping in the rain. There's a pause, a flicker of surprise that John can't quite track, and then Jaster says, "Yes, of course, the rain is indeed vastly overrated." Bemused, John tips his head, but from this angle, with Jaster wrapped around him, he can't see his face. It's not urgent enough a matter that John feels the urge to move, either, so he just stays still, carefully slotting their fingers together. Another shiver shakes Jaster, but it's milder than before, and John pulls the blankets in a little closer and closes his eyes. He's tired and sore, but it's nowhere near as bad as it could be. All the rest before the assassin's attack was more than he would ever usually allow himself, and it made everything easier. 4 days and a handful of hours until the wedding, John thinks, and he can feel it waiting, just out of reach. Something will happen, but he has no idea the shape it will take. And regardless of what does happen, in the aftermath, John will be married. He'll have a husband. Jaster will be his husband. John swallows, thinks of the kiss Jaster pressed to his knuckles yesterday morning, the way he gripped John's chin, stood close enough to kiss. It makes his skin tingle, and he can't stop thinking about the beat of Jaster's pulse beneath his fingertips, the heat of him. Jaster is pressed entirely up against him, wrapped around him, and John can feel the heartbeat against his back, the breaths against his hair. He wants with everything in him, to roll over and push Jaster onto his back, curl over him, and kiss him, and never get up. He doesn't, because Jaster's hands are curled together against his chest, still cold, and Jaster's grip is still bruising like he's desperate not to let go. But the wanting doesn't diminish, and John thinks of the wedding, of the vambrace with its green crystal, of the press of Jaster's lips against his knuckles, and how it bled awareness into every centimeter of John's skin. "Balance," Jaster says, almost aggressive. "Balance is an equal proportion of all things, so equal parts of darkness and light." John very, very carefully doesn't let his humor show, but he leans back against the headboard, watching Jaster pace. "Balance is equilibrium." Jaster jabs a finger at him like he just made Jaster's point for him. "Precisely. Equal parts to weight both sides of the scale equally." That's not how it works. John watches the disbelief, annoyance, and indignation that flicker over Jaster's features and doesn't smile, though it's hard. Your version of balance implies that there can be too much light. "Supernovas," Jaster says, indignant, and folds his arms across his chest. "Too much light all at once can kill." "That isn't how it works," John repeats. "Don't think of it as light and dark. It's kindness and cruelty. You can't have too much kindness. You don't need cruelty to survive." Jaster opens his mouth, pauses, closes it. Then he scowls, deep and displeased. "Then why would you refer to it as the dark side?" John isn't going to laugh at him. At least, not openly. "Because when you fall to it, it's a vast, consuming thing that swallows you whole and doesn't let the light of hope or kindness in, like darkness." For a long, long moment, Jaster stares at him, eyes narrowed. Then, loud and pointed, he lets out an annoyed breath and sinks down on the other side of the bed again, snatching up his book like it offended him. "JT," he mutters, "you know you could simply call things what you mean." "Saying someone fell to selfishness sounds less dire," John says. He can feel Jaster's heat through the thin cotton of his shirt, can see, without turning his head, the line of Jaster's throat and the curve of his wrist, the tendons there. It makes his mouth dry, makes him want to turn and look, and, at the same time, look away. And a Force user who falls to the dark side is dangerous, not just selfish. Jaster huffs and doesn't answer, flipping through pages to find his next marker. There are, John notes with amusement, quite a few markers, and they're only 30 or so pages in. Fine. Kyber. The Jedi are the only people who use Kyber to such an extent, and interact with it regularly. Is it sentient? John pauses, caught off guard by the question, and Jaster's gaze immediately snaps to him, his eyes narrowing. It is? Turning the question over, John considers the answers, the pitfalls of each one. Not quite, or only when it's older. Kyber is connected to the Force the same way the Jedi are. It resonates the same way. Old Kyber, Kyber that's been in Jedi hands for a long time, it gains semi-sentience, particularly if a Jedi who resonates with it is nearby. Jaster stops, frowning as he chews that over. Particular Jedi resonate more? Every Jedi is called to a particular Kyber crystal, John corrects. We pick the one that we're drawn to for our lightsaber, or more than one sometimes, but certain crystals speak louder to some Jedi than others, like some boots fit certain feet and others fit different feet. Boots, Jaster repeats, faintly pained. You're describing the resonance of souls and unearthly crystals, and your chosen metaphor is boots. John flushes faintly, but he snorts too. You understood my meaning, he points out. Jaster sighs, pointed, like John can't feel his amusement. Very well, my future husband does not have the soul of a poet, and I suppose I will endure. Is there a symbiotic bond between Jedi and Kyber crystals that allows a lightsaber to function in Jedi hands and not for anyone else? No, John says, trying to hide his amusement. Most Jedi put secret switches on the inside of the casing that they trip with the Force. It's why lightsabers tend to go off when we drop them. Jaster freezes, eyes widening, then narrowing again sharply. That, he says with indignation, is cheating. John can't help it anymore. He gives in and laughs, ducking his head so his hair will hide his face as he tries to keep it silent. It shakes through him, trembles in his chest, but he feels bright, light, loose. It's warm, and he doesn't hurt, and Jaster is solid and tangible beside him. There's a sound of indignation, sharp and entirely for show, and a loose hand catches John's shoulder, Jaster's continued closeness enough to keep it from being startling. Jaster drags him around, halfway forward, and John has to catch himself on Jaster's shoulder before he goes spilling right into Jaster's lap. He can't stop laughing, even with that, and Jaster's fingers close tight around his wrist. You're laughing at me, again, Jaster accuses, and one hand tangles in John's hair, brushing it back like Jaster is seeking evidence of his claim. John can't even resist. He shakes with his laughter, lifts his head. Jaster is staring at him, dark eyes gone even darker than normal, and beneath the hand he has on Jaster's chest, John can feel his quickened heartbeat, the hitch of his breath. It jars through him, a sudden, breathtaking sort of awareness of the fact that Jaster is bare centimeters away, watching him. Like yesterday, he's close enough to kiss, but there's less space between them now, more touch. And John wants to lean in, to fit his mouth to Jaster's, just wants to see what it would be like, if it would dampen the heat or grow it, if Jaster's mouth is as soft as it looks. That's the fourth time I've heard you laugh, Jaster says, and it's a hoarse thing, caught up in his throat. His thumb drags over John's temple, fingers twisting just a little tighter in his hair, and John tries to catch his breath and finds he can't. Want is a vast and almost foreign thing, dug deep into his chest. He can't remember the last time he laughed before Jaster found him on the battlefield. "You keep track?" he asks, and Jaster's mouth curves, something so sweet, John almost closes the space between them at last. He wants that warm smile, the way Jaster is looking at him right now. And Jaster hasn't looked away. "It's a pretty thing to see you laugh, and rare," Jaster says, low, and his hand slips from around John's wrist, settles on his hip instead. His fingers curl, like he wants to draw John in, and John's breath catches. "I have a reason here," he says softly, and it shivers through him like vulnerability, like an opening left in the middle of a fight, but softer, blunted around the edges, warm in the center. And when Jaster's hand slides up the curve of his lower back, John can feel the heat of his palm like the sun against his skin. "I'm glad I can provide such entertainment," Jaster says, but his eyes are still on John, and he strokes his thumb across John's back. It makes John shiver, eyes fluttering closed, and Jaster breathes out a sharp sound that's almost a protest, almost a plea. "John," he says, and John can't think of a single thing in all the universe except leaning in and kissing him. So he does. Jaster's mouth is hot and soft and sweet like the coffee he drinks, and John can feel his sharp sound of surprise like it's inside his own skin. The way Jaster's whole body trembles for one fractured heartbeat. The hand in his hair pulls tight, and Jaster kisses back, pushes up against John like he's starved for contact, and John burns. He kisses Jaster carefully, desperately, wants to crawl inside this moment and pull it tight around them so it never changes. Jaster's arms go tight, and John's heart is pounding, deafening, like beating wings inside his chest. He shifts forward, slides all of the way into Jaster's lap, and then, ragged, wretched, Jaster makes a sound of denial. He wrenches his mouth away, surges to his feet, and John almost falls off the bed as he's suddenly overbalanced. He grabs the headboard, only just manages to catch himself in time, and rises, but it's already too late. The door slams shut, and Jaster is gone, stalking down the hallway with want burning under his skin and every last one of his thoughts fixed on John. John stays where he is for a long moment, trying to catch his breath, and then, slowly, carefully, slides off the mattress and sinks to the ground. He curls forward, pressing his forehead to his knees, and squeezes his eyes shut, trying to ignore the way his mouth is still hot and sensitive, the shiver that runs all through him. Jaster wants him. He felt that. Surprise, but there was want and something gentle, and he's been counting how many times John laughs. But he left. He threw himself out of the bed as if it were on fire and disappeared without even taking his boots with him. It wasn't wrong, John thinks, and opens his eyes, raising his head. He rakes his hands through his hair, frustration rising, and he's not angry, but maybe it's something close. Jaster wants him, but like when he bolted out of the room the other morning, like when he took Arla's place on the scouting squad, he's conflicted, confused. John doesn't know what Jaster is conflicted about, though. He thought, but Jaster did want him, and Jaster is going to marry him. He hasn't mentioned anyone else, and he wants John. Jaster kissed him back. He'd wanted to keep going, and made himself pull away. John isn't going to try and kiss him again. Not when Jaster doesn't seem to know what he wants. All he can think about is the look in Jaster's eyes, though. The desperate slant of his mouth as he kissed back. The way his hand went tight on John's back and his body pressed up. Jaster likely still thinks John is going to object to the wedding, But the kiss should have proved to him that John won't. It should be obvious, at this point, that John isn't going to disappear into the night the way Jaster told him he could at the beginning. John wants this. He won't walk away. The marriage might be a debt paid, but it's John's choice to go through with it in all ways. Still, there's no use pushing. Jaster might feel more confident after the wedding, when he can be sure that John means what he said. It's frustrating, though. John's never allowed himself so close to anyone, has never wanted anyone this way. Not so openly, so readily. And he may not have had sex with anyone before this, but he understands it, recognizes that it can be emotional, but can also just be physical. Jaster wants him. John wants him in return. The solution seems simple, and the fact that they're getting married in 4 days just makes it more so. John has little idea of what goes on in a marriage, what the lines are, but surely there are worse things to build a connection on than shared want and the kindness in each of Jaster's touches. But John thinks, and raises his head. He doesn't know Mandalorian traditions well, and there might be something he's missing. There's likely something he's missing. But that, at least, is easily addressed. Not by Jaster, because it feels as though confronting him right now won't do either of them any good. Not Arla or Jango, either, because John would melt into the floor in humiliation if he tried to talk to either of them about Mandalorian marital traditions. But he pushes to his feet, carefully, slowly, dresses the same way, in the robes Jaster had made for him, gray and green, and leaves the cloak on its hook. After a long second of debate, he pulls his hair up the way he would normally, twisting it into a loose knot to keep it out of his face. It leaves the scars obvious, but right now, with the feeling of Jaster's mouth still hot against his own, John finds he minds far less than he normally would. Then, with steady steps, he leaves the room, following the bend of the hallways towards a familiar office. When he knocks on Miles' door, no one answers, but John considers it for a moment, then glances at the mechanism. It's opened with a code, not a key, and he holds a hand over it for a long moment, testing, sensing. The force bends through the universe, all of it at once, and he breathes in, breathes out, and lets his fingers fall where Miles's usually do, without hesitation. There's a quiet beep before the door slides open, and John lets himself in. He doesn't want to wait in the hall, where he might see Arla or Jango or even Jaster. He still feels a little too raw for that. Miles is someone safely removed, though, and John sinks down to the floor in the corner, crossing his legs beneath him, then straightening his back and closing his eyes. He needs meditation after this afternoon, and just starting the breathing helps settle him a little. It takes a long time, but John is in no rush. The sun is starting to go down outside the window, filling the room with golden light, before the lock beeps again and the door slides open. John slowly opens his eyes, watching Miles enter with a tray of tea and a bowl full of sweets, looking tired. He's shaved since this morning, and he looks worn as he drops the tray on his desk and falls into his chair, rubbing his hands over his face. "I hope that's not all you're eating for dinner," John says, and at the first word, Miles startles, yelps, and almost knocks over the bowl of sweets. He's on his feet again in a fraction of a second, blaster drawn, and John blinks at him, then gets to his feet. "Criff," Miles says after a long moment, and shoves the blaster back into its holster, throwing himself down in the chair again. "How did you get in here? I just changed the passcode this morning." "The Force," John says, and Miles pauses, expression twisting, and then sighs loudly. "I think I just realized how Jaster feels when I say that to him," he says ruefully. "Are you here about the choice of music for the wedding? Because I know I sent Jaster those files 6 hours ago, and if you want to change them now..." No, John says, and Miles makes a sound of relief, then tips his head at one of the empty chairs. John takes it, and Miles gathers the spilled sweets, then pours two cups of tea. I thought Django would be stopping by, he says. You've spared him my twig water. Make sure to remind him of that next time you see him. John picks it up, cradled in both hands, and breathes in the steam. He closes his eyes for a long moment, letting the sharp, herbal smell ease whatever tension his meditation left, and then says quietly, "Thank you." "You're welcome," Miles says, bemused, and then picks up his own cup as he sinks back in his chair. "Has Jaster driven you to murder with his questions yet?" John thinks of Jaster's absolute determination to shake John down for every possible answer about Jedi life, and can't help but smile. "Not yet." "Oh, good. I'd hate to have to put a bounty on your head." Miles eyes him for a moment, then makes a sound of amusement. "Another one? You were meditating?" For a moment, John considers the pale blue surface of the tea, then raises his head and meets Miles' eyes. "Do Mandalorians wait for sex until after they're married?" Miles stares at him blankly for a long, long stretch of seconds. Then, deliberate, he sets his tea on the desk, leans down to fish around underneath it, and comes up with a bottle that's brown and dusty and entirely unlabeled. Uncorking it, he dumps a generous measure in his cup, then takes a big swallow, slumps forward, and buries his face in the curve of his elbow. "I hate him," he says, faintly plaintive. "I hate him so much." John carefully hides his amusement. "No," he concludes, "they don't." "They really, really don't," Miles says, aggrieved. He still hasn't lifted his head. "Did he tell you that? Do you want me to help you hang him from something really tall by his underwear?" "I just wanted to be sure," John says. He watches Miles grope for his cup, then pull it in to take another swig, and hides his smile. "I kissed him. He'll likely find somewhere else to sleep tonight." "Probably," Miles says on a sigh, and slants a look at John, assessing. "You're taking this well." John considers his tea for another moment. "He didn't call the wedding off," he says after a second, "and he wants me back. I felt it. And he still has the same doubts. After the wedding and the Vambrace, maybe he'll believe me then." "Hopefully," Miles sighs, and reaches for the bottle again. He tops off his cup, then offers it to John. "If you kissed Jaster, you might want some of this to burn off the germs. That much stupidity might be contagious." John eyes the bottle, not overly inclined to trust it. He can heal most things, but Cor and I live on a planet where vast expanses of the atmosphere are viciously poisonous, and their tolerance for toxins tends to be high. He's not so confident about his own. "I'm all right with tea, thank you," he says, and Miles makes an unimpressed sound, but sets the bottle aside. He nurses his cup for a few minutes, letting the silence stretch, and then sighs again and rubs at his forehead in frustration. "Jaster is too noble for his own good," he says. "He always has been. That's why he killed that criffing bastard of a journeyman protector and got himself exiled from Conquered Dawn in the first place. He sees someone doing something wrong, and it makes him mad as hell. I guess this is what happens when he thinks he's the one doing something wrong." "Jaster isn't doing anything wrong. John can feel it, and even if he did object to this, even if he didn't think that being married to Jaster might be something good, because Jaster is a man who counts every time he laughs and touches his scars so lightly. Even if none of that were true, he would stay just because the Force says Jaster is important, says his entire family is important, and all John wants is to keep him safe and alive and moving forward." "He's not," John says, and he looks up, meets Miles' eyes and holds them, sees the weight of tiredness and fondness and worry there. He hasn't done anything wrong. He'll believe it eventually. Miles breathes in, lets his breath out on a sigh. "I'll take your word for it," he says with a crooked smile, and leans back in his chair. "All right, if you're here, make yourself useful and look at some security maps. And don't break into my office just to give me a heart attack in the future." End of chapter 14.